Hello, everyone, and welcome into debate night yet again. I'm Hunter, joined as always by Brody, Silas in the booth. I am back from vacation, and Brody is in a different part of Oregon this week. You're a little farther north, or is it the same part of Oregon?
No, we're south.
It's farther south.
We're 40 minutes south of the airport.
And where? Portland?
I have no idea.
Oh, you don't know where you're at. Did you fly from Portland to this place?
No. 40-minute drive.
Okay.
I think it's Estacada.
Yep, that sounds right. That sounds right.
It's the nearest city, which whatever is that is.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Beaver State Fling Silver Series is going down this weekend. A lot of history with that tournament, but first we got to walk through Portland Open some. And we're going to give you, you know, plenty of time to walk through what happened on your game and all that, Brody. But first, we got to just start off. Last week on this show, you came on saying, why are we playing Blue Lake? Seems very like an easy course. Seems like, you know, hot round could be 17 under.
I don't think I said that.
You definitely said that. And then you came out and put up it. Do we need to go back to last week? Silas,
you said that.
You remember it, right?
I think I might have said that jokingly.
But you said
it. You can't. You said it. The words came out of your mouth.
I still have yet to have anyone send me the actual clip of me saying it.
Okay, well, now that I know you're looking for it, I'll find it.
I might not have said it.
Regardless, you know you said it was an easy course, and then you did proceed to go out there. Did proceed to go out there and shoot an even par the first round, though.
Yeah, I played terrible.
Yeah, so walk us through that first round.
Which is even worse. Shooting even par on an easy course is even worse.
Yeah.
Than shooting even par on a hard course. But I guess, you know, again, when, you know, sometimes I say stuff and we don't necessarily have all the time in the world to really dissect exactly what I'm saying, but my point really with Blue Lake was more in the sense that there's some holes where we're just like, why the heck are we playing this?
Yeah.
This hole, for example, a good example of that, which I'm sure has gotten lots of talk with how Nate Sexton and Big Germ did the commentary on hole 9. I was shocked, okay, because there's like 40 people probably in at Portland Open that were like non-touring pros, right? Like more of your local pros or just people that were able to get in the tournament. So there was a decent amount of like of the bottom of the field, right? And so when someone asked me like, hey, what do you think, what percentage of the field do you think birdied hole 9? What do you think the answer of that was?
I have no idea.
You know, there was 105 people. There's like 40 people, 30 people that aren't touring pros playing. What do you think the percentage was of people that birdied hole 9?
We'll go 50. We'll go 45%.
90%.
So like the entire field.
I was shocked. I thought like 70 because I was like, I'm pretty sure anyone in the top 50 birdied that hole.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I bet like half the people at the bottom birdied it and half didn't. 90% of the field birdied it. So when you have, and my point was like, and I'll just run through the course real quick.
Okay.
Hole one, really hard birdie, but really hard to bogey. Hole two, good hole. Because it takes a good shot to birdie, and if you throw a bad tee shot, you can actually bogey that hole. Hole three, good hole. Hole four, not a good hole. 295, pretty standard. You're either making a two or a three. No real chance of bogeying that hole. Hole four, kind of on the cusp of like a good hole, bad hole. Hole six, 270 feet, stock hyzer, or a straight shot, bad hole. Hole seven, great hole. Hole eight, great hole. Don't really like the drop zone, but good hole. Hole nine, not a good hole. Hole 10, eh. Hole 11, not a good hole. So I'll stop there because I'm sure people are over me going through it. But my point was there's just a lot of holes on that course where it's very difficult to get a bogey.
Yeah.
And I think you saw that on the front nine. Now the back nine has a lot of good holes. And I'll say like the hole 18 is pretty easy, but that stretch coming in of like 14, 15, 16, 17 is a really awesome stretch of holes. So I guess when I was saying like this course is too easy, I mean, obviously I shot even par one round and then shot six under another round, which still wasn't that great. I didn't even play that well towards the back nine. But, you know, I made like seven birdies in a row, I think, one of the rounds. And it really didn't feel like I was doing anything special.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's my point of where you can kind of just putz around and keep the disc in play out there and shoot a really good score. So
how much harder stroke wise do you think Glendevere played?
See, I thought Glendevere was going to be much harder than it actually played.
Yeah.
But once I got through Glendevere, like I played, I feel like Glendevere, obviously it's no spoilers here. I didn't play well this tournament at all. I played pretty poorly, all four rounds. And, you know, I didn't actually score that bad at Glendevere. So I was more surprised, I would say, with how easy Glendevere played than I was how difficult Blue Lake played. But also, you got to take into account, too, like Blue Lake, it was raining and the winds kind of picked up one of the days. And then also just the ground, we were like playing in like a mud pit, essentially. Mm. So I think that caused some issues here and there. It probably played a little bit harder than it normally does when it's dry. But yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised with how easy Glendevere played. And I think once we obviously did scoring rounds, because again, it's very difficult when you're playing a course for the first time and you haven't gotten any scoring rounds out there. And all you're really doing is throwing a bunch of shots on every hole because you only get like two practice rounds on it. So at both Blue Lake and Glendevere, I didn't probably have the best knowledge, but like looking back at how Blue Lake scored in past tournaments, you know, I'm pretty sure Kevin Jones shot 15 or 16 under when they played there in 2019. Besides, you can fact check me there, but I'm pretty sure he shot 16 under. Yeah. So
I was just going to, because I was looking at the two scores, why I even brought it up is when it was all said and done, if you look at the total fields average score, Glendevere between two rounds averaged almost, it was like 3.5 strokes easier than Blue Lake.
Well, because there's rounds. Round four was the cut.
Yeah, I
was gonna say, I'd be surprised too. When you do these like scoring, when you do averages or when you're looking at stats and stuff of the courses, you really have to like only take into account like the top 50, 60 players.
Yeah.
Because the bottom, for example, like you can go on that course, you can go and look at some of the people that like finished towards the bottom. And because Blue Lake just had so much OB, and again, the OB doesn't really come into play for most people. But if you're not playing well and you don't really throw that far, which is probably going to be the people towards the bottom of the field, you can rack up scores there. So that's why you see people that shot 87 and 80 at Blue Lake, but shot 75 at a much longer Glendevere.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't that much OB at Glendevere. And that was after actually doing a scoring round. It was very difficult to birdie out there. There was really only a handful of holes where you felt like, okay, I have to get this birdie. And the rest of them, it was very difficult to birdie out there, which I think you saw in the scores. It wasn't like we had anyone go out and just, you know, have 15, 16 birdies like we do on some courses. But it was really hard to bogey a lot of holes. really hard. Like, you had to really throw bad shots, like really bad shots to bogey. And even then, you had like a lot of all my bogeys, I want to say, that I had at Glendevere, I could have saved par. But it was either a missed circle one putt that caused me to bogey, or, you know, I had like a 250-foot upshot that I flubbed.
Yeah.
And, you know, threw it to 40 feet and then missed the putt. So there was very few holes where you're like, crap, like, I have no chance. I have no chance to save par from here. Where Blue Lake, with how much OB there was a lot of holes where if you went OB on your tee shot, you're like, all right, my best score is bogey now. So I think that's why the scoring was what it was. But I think a lot of people liked it. I'm kind of, I haven't really heard from, you know, the fans on what they thought about Blue Lake and Glendevere. Players wise, it's always, you know, it's always interesting to hear what people say. I think a lot of times I think it's hard for players to separate their performance with how they like a course. So you kind of have to take that. But, you know, I think Glendevere definitely has a lot of potential for sure. And obviously it being its first time with the tournament there, I think they can see like, okay, this hole needs to be tweaked a little bit. This one didn't really have any scoring separation. Let's try to figure that out. Like, I'm hoping they keep the bones of the course for next year and they kind of just adjust and tweak a few more things.
Is there any specific hole you'd want changed?
I think the worst hole out there, there's not really that many bad holes, but I think the worst hole out there that definitely needs some sort of change would be hole 11 is the par 5 down. And then it's 12. Is it 14? I think it's 14. It was the hole right before the really good par 4 where you have like the two trees that you have to throw through and like throw a huge turnover. And like Simon went OB early, right? I think on his throw on the final day.
Okay.
It's like the 820 or 840 foot par 4. That's a really good hole. I think it's hole 14. It's like a 450 foot par 3.
That's hole 13.
Is it hole 13?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Hole 13 is what I'm talking about. It's like 450 par 3, no OB, no hazard. And there's just a bunch of there's nothing in the way for like 400 feet. And then the last like 50 feet, 60 feet, there's just a bunch of trees. And there's not really a gap. Like, there's not like a I played with a whole bunch of people. No one was like, this is the type of throw I'm throwing here. Everyone was just throwing a shot and then just hoping to get through. And surprisingly enough, a 450 foot par 3, you would think it would play pretty difficult. It was the second easiest hole. Not because there was a lot of birdies there, just because literally it might have been impossible to bogey that hole. Like, you would have to probably three putt to bogey it, because you just chuck a shot up there and then you have, you know, either a putt for birdie from circle two or you chip up for your par. So that would probably be the only hole. I wish we had more holes like hole one. I think I was talking to someone with course design. I think in golf, you have like the tees and fairways in line, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you have like a dog leg where it's just like a soft shaping curl. I think to make disc golf more difficult, which is I think what a lot of times we're trying to do, is you instead of having the fairway, you know, here, you know, okay, how am I doing? here's the tee and then the fairway is like this vertical, right? So you're sitting down. Instead of being like that, have the fairway more perpendicular to the tee. So like hole one, I don't know if this looks right, but this is how hole one was shaped.
Okay.
Right? So we were throwing on to a fairway that was left to right, like slanting left to right. So one, it was really easy to go through the fairway, OB, right? And then when you're playing that hole, it allows you to dictate how aggressive you want to play. And so that's where even on hole one, you saw so many different types of shots. You saw people throw forehands. You saw people throw mid turnovers. You saw people throw fairway turnovers. You saw a lot of different strategy on how you played that hole, because it wasn't just simply throw a disc as far as you can and then play from where it is. So I love that, of where you can decide how aggressive you want to get. And obviously if it pays off, you have an easier upshot for your birdie, but you're bringing in a lot of OB and you know, hole 18 is another perfect example, right? Another hole where you're throwing your tee shot onto a perpendicular landing zone, which I love. So you can do what some guys were doing, which was throwing all the way up close to that Mando,
yeah,
that first Mando way up there. Or you can kind of play the hyzer over the lake left and be, now you're really far away, but it's a little bit safer. Or you can like chip short of the water. So I love those type of holes. And it looks like kind of some of these new design courses that we're playing. OTB had a couple holes like that. Portland now has had a couple holes like that. I'm trying to think if Jones Supreme had any holes like that. I don't think they did. But I love that idea. I love that new course design idea, because as a player, it makes you have to think like how aggressive you want to get.
Yeah, where you want to land. I saw us, you mentioned Mando, and I saw a post. I have not fact checked this because it just came back into my head. So A, tell me if this is way off base. But someone said that they thought, or they counted, that Glenn DeVere had, I think it was Glenn DeVere,
36.
I was going to say 19 Mandos.
Oh, I was way off. I just guessed.
Does that sound about right? Was there a lot of Mandos out there, it felt like?
Did it? Oh, yeah, there was definitely a lot.
Did it feel like there
was a lot of Mandos when you guys were watching?
I didn't get to catch a ton of the coverage. I was watching mainly scores. But I was saying, what you playing, was that something you noticed a lot?
Guys, like, did you watch? You're
sick of it.
Yeah, I watched a little bit of it. I watched more of the ending, so I got the other course a lot.
No, we're talking about Glenn DeVere, the last course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
What are some of the people in the comments saying about it?
Because that's what
I'm curious about that, because that was definitely that course had more Mandos than any course we played by a mile.
Yeah, but I think that was okay. I didn't feel like there were too many. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you have to do, and I would even suggest that they probably need to add a couple more Mandos, because there were a couple holes that, you know, I was playing with Calvin today, a practice round, and he was talking how a couple of the shots that he was playing were, he felt like were the like intended line for the course design. But when you don't have a Mando, people will find other routes.
Well, we saw the Simon line where he just threw the hyzer, kind of broke the hole, but it was more of a risky shot.
It's not that risky. That's what me and Ezra did.
Yeah.
That shot actually isn't risky at all, because you're throwing, and this is why you probably need a Mando there, because one, that's a really hard birdie hole just to begin with. Regardless of whether you go the hyzer route or like the turnover or the forehand where the intended throw is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But when you go left side, you bring OB into play. And you saw that, like Isaac Robinson, he went OB long. Really easy to throw OB going the left side. The hyzer, when me and Ezra did our practice round out there, we found that the hyzer at best probably gets us to like 30 feet right of the basket, but the worst, it's just out in the middle of the fairway and you just chip up and take your three.
Yeah.
So the only reason I didn't do that the final round is when we were like playing those first couple holes, the wind picked up significantly. It kind of died down throughout the day, but it was probably 10, 15 miles per hour. And it was like a head left to right. And I was like, okay, there's no way this disc is getting anywhere near there. So,
Do you feel like on that hole, do you feel like on that hole it needs a Mando, or would it just be solved by moving the tee forward? Like,
no, I think
20 feet, 10 feet.
See, I think if you want, I don't like moving the tee forward, because I like where it's at, because it allows the turnover, which is a hard shot, and it allows the inside forehand.
Okay.
I would say If you don't want to put a Mando there, which is fine, you can do that. The other way to do it is you literally make that fairway on the right all OB. So now the people that are throwing that hyzer shot out there, that is a risk reward shot. If you pull it off, you probably have a putt. But if you know it, you get it too wide and you hit the tree, or it doesn't swing as much as you thought, you literally just threw a shot basically all OB, and now you're having to re-tee. So I love that kind of idea too. If you want to continue to, you know, because I know people love seeing those types of shots as well.
Yeah.
But when there's no risk involved, that's where it's tough for me, because you want to reward players for taking risky shots.
See, that's a clip. I saw the clip on Twitter, and Simon was throwing over the gallery. So in my head, it was OB.
No, that's all in play.
Oh, yeah. Then why not pitch it out there?
Yeah, my first round, I clipped the tree, because you do have to kind of like...
It's a weird angle.
In front.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to fade it in front of these trees. And mine ended up kind of flipping up a little more than I expected. Clipped the tree. So I was like 200 feet away, pin high, in the middle of the fairway.
Mm.
And so I just threw a putter up and made par and moved on.
Yeah.
To me, that should probably be out of bounds. And that would be my biggest takeaway for Glendevere, is moving forward. I think that's what they need to look at, is those type of shots of, okay, when someone goes way, you know, some of these holes require rollers. So it's like, okay, how do we make it? Hole four is a great hole. Like, I love hole four. It's a roller hole for most people, but the whole left side is OB. So you're throwing your roller out over OB and having it kind of come in. And if your angle's off or anything's wrong, you know, you're basically having to re-tee essentially. So I like that kind of play of where, you know, you're basically making it to where bad shots get really penalized, because you're not really penalizing someone being 200 feet left of the basket because their roller never stood up. That person is just getting a par. They're not having to. And that's the tricky thing right now, is everyone's so good that anything like inside of 200 feet on a course like that, without that many trees, you're getting up and down.
Yeah.
You should be. If you're not, you're going to end up being where I am, you know, down the leaderboard. So with how easy putting is right now, that's where it's really tricky. And until they can figure out a way of making putting more difficult, you have to, unfortunately, really penalize bad shots on the tee. I don't love it. Like, I would love to have it to where if you're 200 feet away, like, not everyone's going to throw that under the basket every time. You're sometimes going to throw it to 20 feet. And I would love if, like, a 20-footer was a little bit more difficult than what it is now. But it's not. So the only way of really making, like, score separation happen to where you're not having – you know, someone that threw a good shot to 50 feet and missed their putt, and someone that shanked it 200 feet left, and now they just chip up and get the same score. You got to do hazard. You got to do OB. To me, I think also I think hazard is something that is super underutilized, clearly, because we never see it. And I think a course like this, where you're having a lot of people throw big flex shots, big rollers, I love hazard way more than OB. Because I want the person that barely missed the fairway to not get as penalized as the person that just completely shanked it and it's way over there. Now they have to go way over there and throw.
Yeah,
I love that for making kind of really bad shots. Not because with OB, everyone just pulls it back in. You're on the fairway again.
Yeah, Silas, did anyone in the chat bring up what they thought of the Mando situation?
Yeah, yeah. The majority of people like me were saying that it wasn't super noticeable.
Yeah.
Like at all. And I like commentary didn't even mention it really. I didn't think they needed to. I think it just blended well.
It's just how the course played. So I guess as players, if y'all didn't feel like it was too much to keep track of, then
yeah,
is what it is. I just saw someone post about it, so I was curious what it felt like playing it.
No, it, like I said, if anything, it needed probably more. I will say the number one rule that's broken on tour. What do you think it is?
The number one rule that's broken on tour. Probably where you run up. Well, is that even the same rule anymore? I was going to say where you plant your foot in accordance to a mando versus the basket, but I think they changed that rule.
Think about how many times that actually happens. You got to think of something that happens, like something that people are in the situation quite frequently. Because what you just mentioned.
I was just thinking because the mando. I was saying because mandos. We're just talking.
That might happen one out of like 10.
Well, I also think they changed. I also think they changed that rule. So I don't even think that's it anymore. The most broken rule. I have no idea. I mean, I would say like foot faults that just never get called.
That's what I was going to say.
It's foot faults. So obviously you have the putting foot faults with people jumping. You know, there's pictures and videos of people both feet off the ground and the disc is still in their hand.
Yeah.
There's, you know, people have taken 100 screenshots of me step putting where they're claiming my foot is on the ground and the disc is still in my hand. Those are probably the number, like those for sure. But the other foot fault is people throwing from out of bounds. And I've seen it happen multiple times. I've seen it happen on coverage. I've seen it happen in person.
Where their foot's still on the ground when they throw? Is what you're saying?
No one throws the power backhand and their back foot is off the ground when the disc is out of their hand. It's impossible. It is not physically possible to throw far with your back foot off the ground.
Are you sure about that?
Yes.
I want to look up the pictures.
Pull up anyone throwing. You have to use the ground to push off of.
You're pushing into your release. So like you're bracing, all your weight's being transferred to your front foot and your back foot is pushing.
It doesn't come off though until after the disc is out of your hand. Try to throw, like people watching this right now or listening. Next time you're out of the golf course, like over exaggerate making sure your back foot's off the ground before you release the disc, and you will realize real quick.
I don't know.
That is not a
here. I found it. Got a picture of Paul throwing, back foot fully off the ground, disc still in hand.
Hold up, let me see it. Is he throwing a power shot?
Yeah, off the tee, putting a ton of power in it. How do I sending this to you, Silas? How am I getting this on here? All right, I'm downloading this image. I'm going to airdrop it. Nope, can't even airdrop it to Silas. How on earth, how are we getting this on the stream, Silas?
Yeah, we need to get this on the stream. Prove me wrong.
All right, Silas, what?
I've had multiple.
Can I put it in the knots? Okay, give me a second here.
I mean, I'm watching a slow-mo of him throwing and his back foot's on the ground the whole time.
I'm not going to say it's every single time. But I'm going through and there's a Shoestrick frame by frame that his back foot's off. There's another Paul frame by frame. His back foot's off.
I mean, this is way.
There's
out
no,
of his hand.
But there's no weight on his back foot there. So like I can see where you can do it.
Well, hold on. Hold on. I'm not saying you can't do it. What I'm saying is not actual throw. Again, that's what I'm trying to say. Not saying it's impossible.
I'm putting this in the NAS. In the NAS, the nasty NAS. How's it actually pronounced, Silas?
Brody doesn't even know about that.
No, he probably doesn't. I'm gonna put it in the Trevor transfer.
It's technically called the NAS. NAS.
Now how the heck do I get
I
something
know what
into
that
here?
Is. Brody, let's look at Eagle. Because Eagle really torques his body.
Team
so he might actually be someone that's good that gets his foot off the bat.
All right, Silas, it should be in the Trevor transfer folder. So that we can throw this on the stream.
Oh, Eagle's close. Eagle is very close. He might be another one that gets his back foot off the ground.
I have no idea what it's called, man. Don't ask me stuff like that. You got it? All right, there it is. All right, it's about to be cut onto your screen. Boom. There's a picture.
Eagle's back foot off the ground.
There's another one. Okay, so Eagle, we got Paul, Eagle. So that does happen.
So certain throwing styles, I will now, I mean, we have a video of Paul doing it and not doing it.
Yeah.
This scenario, Eagles not doing it. Eagles might be the most drastic of all of them.
And he throws far. So you can argue that you really should have your back foot off the ground. Something to think about.
Think so?
I vividly remember at USDGC one year, the first time I ever saw it happen, like intentionally, was Ricky on hole.
Wait a second.
Okay.
This is a dark horse one. He goes, this is weird. His back foot goes off the ground and then
back onto the ground.
And then back. Okay. So here, foot is barely off.
Yeah. Okay. 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 Foot's off the ground.
And then it goes back on the ground.
Fascinating.
Back touching.
That's weird.
What I'm saying is, I think this is my point. My point is, I think it's one of those things where the gray area is so severe, and there are some people that in their head they're like, I know that my back foot is probably not going to be off the ground when I throw this, so they end up just doing a standstill, right?
Yeah,
and I think that they're at a huge disadvantage than the person that's like, oh, well, I'm just gonna do it anyways and see if someone calls me on it. That's my kind of point. So yes, clearly we have seen that even when you're not trying to do it, I'm gonna look up one more person.
Yeah, I was gonna say the one I remember was Ricky, hole 15, I believe it is, at USDGC, the triple Mando hole. It was
his foot was off.
Well, so yeah, so what happened was he went, trying to remember how he got in the situation he was. It was the whole left field was OB, and he had like made the Mando but was OB left. And the line he wanted to throw forehand through, I wonder if it wasn't a Mando.
So it's 100% player dependent.
Yeah, it's just throwing.
Calvin throws probably top 5 foot on the ground the whole time.
Yeah. But he threw a forehand, and I remember what he did was like if his foot was way out of bounds, it opened this lineup he wanted to take. And so what he did is he stood with 1 foot inbounds behind his like marked line now, and 1 foot like, okay. I mean, it's Ricky straddling, so a solid like few feet out of bounds. Pretty and big, so he could throw farther over this OB line, and he asked everyone on the card to watch his off foot. And basically what he did is he wound up and then like lifted his left foot, ripped through, and then planted his left foot so that his whole body was over the OB. But like when the disc released, his foot was off the ground, and then he's put his foot back down. So like gave him this like wide open gap, and it was legal. Everything worked.
I'm fine with that.
It was fascinating because like it was a risky play, but yeah.
Yeah, especially when he knows that like, he clearly knows that he's trying to do something.
Yeah, and he told everyone on the card, like, hey, watch my left foot. What I'm going to do is, like, push off, throw, and then plant again. I want y'all to make sure. And everyone watched it and was like, yeah, that's fine.
I got to see if I'm a foot off or foot on guy. Where do you? Do you know?
I think I'm a foot on for sure because my lower body's so much slower than my upper body. That's my whole problem, my form. My lower body is like a half second behind my upper body. Not actually a half second. I think
Drew, foot off. Drew's a foot off.
Yeah,
guy.
I think that I'm trying to think. I feel or like
at least again in this one.
Trying to think of players like that I know are foot. Paige Pierce's foot never leaves the ground.
No, but I've seen Drew also throw with. I think when he throws like really hard, his foot doesn't leave the ground.
I think it depends on the angle they're throwing too. I think a hyzer, you're more likely to get your foot off.
Your foot come
but
off.
Like a
that
flat,
might be true.
Trying to like drive
that might
flat.
That might be it. Yeah, because Eagle leans over like him and Kevin Jones. It's almost impossible for them to keep their back foot on.
Yeah,
because they lean over so much.
Yeah,
that's 100% what it is, Hunter.
Yeah, I think if you are trying to throw flat or back, you have to have more weight on your back foot as you're pushing through. Which keeps your foot on the ground.
Like there's no way that you can throw like a flat shot with your back foot off the ground.
I think it'd be very hard. You'd be I think he'd be off
balance. Like natural.
Well, because like Paul, when he throws an Anheuser, I don't think his back foot really ever leaves the ground. Like even when he does his follow through, his back foot like slides around. Because like it's unnatural to transfer that much weight.
I'm trying to find Drew throwing something that's not a hyzer, which is
that's very, very difficult.
Very, very hard to do.
he just goes flip your disc on the same amount of hyzer. that's exactly what I do, so I can't say anything. He does it much better than I, but that's still how I play.
I mean a little bit better.
Slightly. But that's my philosophy.
I think you broke the code.
Yeah, I think it's the angle you throw on. So if someone's OB and they don't throw a hyzer, call them on it. That's what we're saying here.
That might be the only way of saying it. Yeah, that's 100% what it is. Because I've only seen him like throw. I've seen a couple of them where he drives in the back foot, but it has to be when he's throwing like a crazy Annie shot.
Yeah,
and not. That's interesting. I literally never thought about that, but there we go. We got it.
Boom.
Broken. Fixed it.
All right.
Well, what else do you got?
I was going to say, let's pivot over to Beaver State Fling. I first want to hear your thoughts on the course and then have a talking point or two. And then I got one final talking point after that.
Are we taking any calls or questions?
We'll take some from the chat for sure.
So Silas, start looking.
If you got questions or topics, throw them in the chat. We'll get through some Beaver State Fling really quick and then take over to that. So what do you think of the course? You got to play it today. You said both. You got to play two practice rounds. There's two courses, right? Or are you just playing one course?
I only did one.
Okay.
I ended up playing with Calvin today. So we did. Our doubles battle comes out tomorrow.
Nice.
I actually have to edit that right after this. So that comes out tomorrow. So make sure you check that out. Also check out the Mulligan video. If you guys are watching or listening and you haven't, definitely check out the Mulligan video. Really, really funny stuff. But we played, I don't know which is which, but we played whichever course we're playing on Friday and Sunday.
Nice. Okay.
In the doubles battle. Didn't really get a good gauge on it because we're literally throwing one shot and moving on. But then me and Ezra got a decent practice round in at the other course yesterday and has some really cool holes, some really, really cool holes. And obviously, if you've ever been out to Milo, it feels unlike any other disc golf course. So it has the D-Glow Preserve, maybe, or Jonesboro, where it's like just you. Like, there's not really anything else out there, right? Because you're like deep in this park. But with the massive trees, the running river by, all that stuff, it's really pretty sweet. There are, you know, obviously there are some holes where you're playing to a parking lot or next to a road where you're kind of getting away from the actual nature of all it. But, you know, I've gotten three rounds in, two at one course, one at the other. And I like it, man. There's a lot of really cool, holes. There's a lot of shots that we don't usually have to throw, which is really cool. I believe it might be West. Something like the first like four or five holes in a row, you're just throwing a different shot every time.
Nice.
Which is always kind of fun to kind of have some courses like this. My thought on this course is like this should be like the baseline.
Okay.
Like this should be like courses that are worse than this or shorter than this or whatever shouldn't be on tour. In my opinion, like this should be like the shorter, because there's obviously a lot of par threes. There's one par five on. There might be like one par five. Yeah, because they made the other par five on the albatross hole.
Yeah.
From Philo. They made that a par four.
Mm.
So I think there might be only one par five in all 36 holes. So there's a lot of, there's a decent amount of par fours, but it's not, it doesn't feel like a super long course. But to me, like this should be like the standard of like a really fun, probably 30 under or so is going to win it. You know, 30 something under is going to, in the 30s, it's probably going to win it. So it is going to be a shootout with, you know, only three rounds.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
So you're saying, are you saying this should be like the base of like Elite Series Pro Tour or Silver Series, like anything on tour is the base?
No, I think this, I think that these courses are good enough for an Elite Series event for sure.
Yeah. So this, I mean, I saw some takes.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, I wish some of the holes were closer together so they could just pick the best 18 out of the 36.
Oh, okay.
Because then that would be an absolutely incredible course, but they're pretty spread out. So yeah, you can't really do that.
Yeah, because I saw some takes on Twitter where, because obviously Beaver State Fling has a decent bit of history in comparison to the Portland Open, and really in comparison to most current Pro Tour events. But one of the big reasons that they can't take a Pro Tour, main Pro Tour stop there is the live coverage, where they can't go live from the course. I even think the Silver Series this weekend, I think that the final round isn't even going to be live, which it always is. I'm pretty sure that it's not going to be this weekend.
Was it like tape delay or something? No, I thought, wait, didn't they, weren't they hyping it up saying first time ever Beaver State Fling live?
Unless they might have changed it. They had made a post a while ago that the Beaver State,
I think they just recently posted something.
They might have been able to figure it out. They might have been able to change it. Because the take I had seen was,
they said it's going to be live.
It is going to be live. Yeah. Oh, heck yeah. Okay. Yeah. So
you been, Hunter?
On vacation. Literally, I've been on vacation. I have my phone was not in my hand most of the weekend. But no, originally they were posting. Originally, they had made a statement. I'm not crazy. It made a statement saying how Beaver State Fling wasn't going to be live this year. And that was like one of the big reasons they couldn't go there. But basically, the take on Twitter was that this is they felt that this was one of the first events where the Pro Tour was choosing money over what was best for the sport, is kind of how they put it.
Explain that.
I think so. Basically, they were saying like this event, the Beaver State Fling courses, history, all of that would be a better event than the Portland Open, but because the Pro Tour could go live, which now it sounds like they could go live at Beaver State, but because the Pro Tour could go live at Portland Open and do all of that, that brings in advertiser money, all of that for the Pro Tour, they were choosing to have that as an Elite Series over Beaver State Fling. So they were saying, like, this is the first time we're seeing.
What's the difference between an Elite Series and a Silver Series?
I mean, I personally, and I'm sure I'm not the only one.
From a fan's perspective,
I care way more about an Elite Series event.
Okay.
I mean, even when the field's stacked at a Silver Series, it doesn't feel that important to me.
Interesting.
Do you feel the same, Silas? Like, do you feel like whoever wins Beaver State will have the same amount of like fanfare as Simon just winning Portland?
Oh yeah, 100%.
You do think so?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so Silas is the opposite of me.
No, I think it's the exact same thing. It seems like it's been hyped up equal.
Well, because like when someone wins a Silver Series, like to me, I immediately am like, yeah, but they haven't won on the Pro Tour. Like if Brody were to win this weekend, for instance. Yeah,
I think a lot of it is feel.
I don't agree with that.
I think it's field strength and I think it's course based. I think those are the two factors that come into play. You have like the Tallahassee Open, for example, not a really popular course. I think it's actually might have been brand new. And you had probably the weakest. I think the Tallahassee Open was probably by far the weakest field in any of the tournaments we've played this year. So you have like a Silver Series like that, but like everyone's at this tournament.
But when you look back on the year, you're not going to know that. You're just going to see it's a Silver Series.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same thing as majors versus Elite Series, right?
That's what, like a major immediately feels like. European Open, for instance, probably won't have as strong of a field as some of the Pro Tour events. But whoever wins the European Open will have won a bigger tournament and will have a, like, immediately a better season in my head. If someone has just the European Open just the Pro Tour win, the European Open win means more, even if the field's worse.
Long term, I definitely see that for sure. But I'm saying short term wise, I think a lot of it, as far as like getting fans interested in watching and that kind of thing, getting fans interested in coming out to the event, I think that's 100%.
Well, coming out, like if they're both near me,
who's playing?
If they're both near me, yeah, I'm not going to care. But I'm saying as like a fan on the East Coast with an event going on the West Coast, so there's no chance I'm going to an event. Like if we had player A and player B, they both had one win. Player A won a Pro Tour that had a weak field.
I don't think that's what we're arguing, though. I'm not arguing that. I'm talking.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm saying
which like, win means more. I like immediately the Beaver State means way less.
I know, but that's not what I'm arguing. My argument is like, what are fans paying attention to during the event?
People pay less attention to Silver Series. There's less talk about it.
I agree. They probably are definitely lower. I think not having live coverage or having any of that definitely hurts. I don't even know if Jomez is going to be out doing post-production here. I don't think they are, actually. I could be wrong. I'm not sure. But if they aren't, then obviously all that goes into play. But I think a lot of these events are going to get to the point of, because even down the road, there's no reason why the Pro Tour, if they have the funds and they have the means, of why they just wouldn't do live at Silver Series as well. Like, there's not, I don't see a reason 5 years from now that they're like, no, we're still, it's a Silver Series, we're not doing live there.
Well, I feel like 5 years from now, Silver Series will just be the way that you earn your way onto the Pro Tour.
It could be. I mean, there's always going to be like a tier system of like upper echelon tournaments and lower echelon tournaments. Like if there is a tournament right after, like here's a good example. Let me pull this up real quick.
Well, cause like if you're able to do live, you're able to get a full field, you're able to get sponsorship money. Why isn't it just a Pro Tour event? Why keep it as a Silver Series?
So, regardless of whether this is a Silver Series event or not, I think there's an event right after Pro Worlds. They're currently registered right now out of the top, and I'm just going off of not going off of world rankings, I'm just going off of Disc Golf Pro Tour.
Yeah.
Points. Two of the top eight people are registered. And then you've got everyone from 9 through 16 except for one person registered. And then sporadically, like, you know, 78%, you know, 80% of 17 through 30s registered. But if you look at just like the top guys, only two of the top eight are going to that.
Yeah.
I think you're going to have, when you have like a big tournament, like a major, something like that, or you have a stretch of big tournament, big tournament, big tournament, and then you have like a, you know, whatever, even if it's not even a, it could be the point too where I think people are, and we're starting to see it, right? We're seeing it with Chris Dickerson. We're seeing it with, I'm trying to think, Calvin, I think, too, is selective on some tournaments as well. I think we're going to see that more and more as the tour continues to grow, of where players aren't going to have to feel like they have to play every event, especially when you start getting to the point of where players, and this is going to be a big change in tour if it ever gets this point, of where players aren't touring in their vehicles.
Yeah.
When people are making enough money to where they can fly in to tournaments, I think you're going to start seeing a lot less, you're going to start seeing players be a lot more picky at what events they're playing, because right now we just play Portland Open, right? So if you're in your van, are you going to just start driving to the Preserve that's in 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Or 3 weeks after the Portland Open, right? Are you going to do that? Or are you going to stick around in Portland for another week to play Beaver State Fling, right? So I think that changes, though, when people are flying. When you start flying into events and stuff, I think we're going to see that. So it'll be interesting to see. I think you're going to have some Elite Series events be bigger, right? And then you're going to have some Elite Series events not be as big as the others. And also, there has to be some sort of, like, I think for the tour to continue to grow too and, like, build names and get people out there, I think you're going to have some sort of, it might not be the Silver Series, but you're going to have some sort of, like, lower tournaments, you know, not worth as much points, not as big of a payout, whatever it may be. Heck, they might even do it, because right now it's kind of weird, right, where like the Disc Golf Pro Tour kind of has its hand in everything. Think about it this way. Think about if the Disc Golf Pro Tour has nothing to do, because it's weird, because the Disc Golf Pro Tour and the Disc Golf Network are so like coincided, right?
Yeah,
they're very dissimilar. So imagine if, let's just throw ESPN in there. Imagine if ESPN was like, hey, we are now taking over and we're doing coverage. So the Disc Golf Network doesn't really, let's just say they don't even exist anymore, right? The Disc Golf Pro Tour has no hand in the USDGC, right? They have no, at that point, there's no connection. So why wouldn't the Disc Golf Pro Tour have like a little mini event during USDGC? Now, obviously, having a mini event during a major, probably not the greatest idea, but this happens on the PGA Tour a lot of times where they have other events, other tours, other like WGC, there's other things going on. And like the top 50 players in the world will go and play this one event. And the PGA Tour is like, well, we're not just going to sit around and not do anything. Like, we will still run an event. It won't have a super strong field, but it will get some newer names out there, newer faces out there. So I still see that being potential down the road. I just don't think the Disc Golf, I don't think the Pro Tour is going to be like every event is just going to be massive. Yeah. I think there has to be some that are just like, you could skip if you're a top 10 guy, you might look at that and be like, I'm not going to go to that one.
Yeah. Now, speaking of like PGA Tour and stuff like that, obviously recently the Saudi backed golf tour, is it Live? What's it called? Live Golf?
Live.
That's obviously been a big storyline. We've seen several more and more notable names stepping off the PGA Tour going to this.
It's not that many notable names, but continue.
Not that many, but more than I expected to happen. I mean, Dustin Johnson, Kevin Na were the two that just came out.
Well, Kevin Na is not surprising. Dustin Johnson's the only one that was kind of like, wow.
Yeah.
If they didn't get Dustin Johnson,
it wouldn't have really been a big thing.
It would actually probably be pretty bad.
Yeah.
It'd be actually really bad.
So, but what I'm thinking is from disc golf perspective, obviously the Disc Golf Pro Tour, nowhere near anywhere close to as established as the PGA Tour. What do you think the Disc Golf Pro Tour and disc golf in general should be looking at in this kind of developing situation with the PGA Tour to learn from / avoid this type of situation in the future where another, like some other company steps in and just basically like, hey, you know, I know the Disc Golf Pro Tour has got this going. Here's a tour with a crazy amount of money. And they try to draw away all the top pros.
Yeah, before we get too kind of crazy here, because obviously you're like the Pro Tour is nowhere near the PGA Tour. 70th place at the Memorial last weekend in the PGA Tour, last cash took home $24,600.
Yeah,
the biggest payout, I believe, in Elite Series history so far, I believe, was the Portland Open. And Stein Lazat took that down and won $10,000. Billy Horschel won the Memorial. It took home $2.16 million.
Yeah.
So just to give you an idea, like, we're not even, I mean, we're not in the ballpark.
No,
We're not in the parking lot.
What I'm saying is,
We're not even in the city.
But it'd be a lot easier.
Suburbs.
So that what I'm saying is, it'd be a lot easier for a company right now to step in and put up way less money than this Live Golf is going to have to compete with the Pro Tour. Like, they could say, "Hey, Like right now, if realistically, if a company came in and they're like, hey, every winner is taking home 40 grand every event for this disc golf tour. That's going to be tough for people not to switch. So I'm saying like
a lot of people would switch.
What should the PGA, what should the Disc Golf Pro Tour be watching right now, do you think, or like key moments of learning potential to avoid this happening in disc golf in the future? Or is it something that we don't need to avoid?
I mean, I don't know exactly all the ins and outs of the LIV PGA Tour situation. There's a lot smarter people that have been following all that that you guys can listen to if you want more of that. But I have listened to some podcasts and stuff talking about it and seen some tweets. I think the real issue that the PGA Tour currently has is how their company is set up. They're set up as a non-for-profit.
Yeah. That's how a lot of sports leagues are right now.
So I don't think so, actually.
I'm pretty sure NFL or someone else is.
No, NFL's profit. I think it's the exact opposite. I think they're in the minority of of sport leagues.
Yeah, the NFL's a nonprofit.
But the teams aren't.
No, the teams aren't. The NBA is also a nonprofit.
But the teams aren't. But
the NHL is also.
I think that's but I think that's where it's tricky is like the teams aren't nonprofit. So but there's no teams. There's no teams in golf though.
Yeah.
So like the NBA isn't paying Steph Curry.
Yeah.
Right? The Golden State Warriors are paying Steph Curry. There isn't a team in golf to pay their players. So that, and I don't know if that's why, like, I don't know if they can't do that because they're a nonprofit or whatnot, but like, that's what is so, that is what's bringing some players over to the LIV Tour. Is because they're straight up just giving people guaranteed money, right? So they're saying, we'll guarantee you, like, you're just a college kid, just graduated, you're a good golfer, we're guarantee you $2.5 million. So you go and you play, and once you make, I guess for some of them, once they make over $2.5 million in these tournaments, then they get more on top of that. But they're at least guaranteed $2.5 million, whether they make it or not, as far as, like, how they do in their tournaments. I think that's really
what it comes down to.
That's really intriguing, obviously, for a lot of people because it's like guaranteed cash. So, but again, like, I don't know. I don't think tennis does anything like that. I don't believe so. Like, I don't think the ATP Tour is paying Federer or Nadal or Djokovic or whoever. I think they're still making all their money by how they do in the tournament and then all their sponsors. So I don't know. It's very, very interesting. I think it's one of those things of where disc golf is such a niche sport right now of where I don't know before like a new tour happens, I think we would have to see people like outside golf companies coming in to try to get a piece of disc.
Yeah.
We would see, you know, a big retail or manufacturing company starting to make discs or, you know, whatever it may be. We would see more of that happening, I think, before we see someone just like, hey, this disc golf thing's pretty crazy. Let's start a whole tour.
Yeah.
I think that is, I just don't foresee that ever happening.
Yeah. I saw it was fascinating.
All this other stuff happens.
We had talked about on Griplock before. Trevor had brought up, like, you know, what it would take, like how the pro tour would be vulnerable type of thing of if a tour started with enough money. And I was saying if the pro tour ever got established enough, I didn't really think that could be something that happened. But then obviously with the PGA tour, way more established, not a threat yet, but I mean, it could continue to be a bigger threat. I mean, I just saw where Tiger Woods turned down nearly $1 billion for this, but like you offer that to the right player, then they might move. And I don't know. I just thought it might be something. Whenever we look at golf, obviously there's so many parallels to how the sport of disc golf's ran. So I think moments like this are great things where we can just look at mistakes that were made, places that they were open up to, what they wish they could have done different if they were at the infancy of their sport to prevent something like that from happening. And then disc golf can like copy and paste it and be like, hey, to make sure this doesn't happen down the road, these are things that like, oh, this is why these players were leaving. Is that something we can implement in disc golf type thing? So I don't know. I just thought it was something interesting to keep an eye on as it continues to develop.
These people, the whole live situation, I think is not a normal situation. It's not like just like a, it's not like the XFL, you know, that's coming in and trying to make a football product. Like there's a lot of political stuff that I don't really know that some people are claiming like that's kind of, you know, they're doing this for other reasons. Like there's a lot of stuff going on over there that I don't really understand. I do know that they're overpaying the crap out of these people.
Yeah.
Right. So clearly when someone is, let's just say the market value for someone is $1 million and you're willing to offer them $10 million, like something weird is happening for you willing to pay someone that much more than their actual value is. So, you know, could someone decide to come in and be like, you know what, for the heck of it, I just want to have my own disc golf tour and offer people ridiculous amounts of money and literally get not everyone, but like the majority of the tour players over to this new tour? Yes. And I think it doesn't take that long for you to look kind of at players' backgrounds with what they've done with sponsorships, how they've moved out, what they've done kind of. To think that they wouldn't jump at, you know, a potential big paycheck. So again, 99% of the people playing disc golf and people playing sports in general, money is a huge, huge thing.
Yeah.
And when you claim it's not, you know, you might be in the 1% that has just so much money, AKA Tiger Woods, that to him, that extra money doesn't really change that much, but him going there, that really puts like a big tarnish on his legacy. And mm-hmm. I think to him, he probably wants to, you know, he values that probably significantly higher. Now, Tiger Woods has, you know, you look at someone like Phil Mickelson who has come out and has talked about like gambling problems and stuff he's had, you know, because he's probably going to sign, I think, with Liv as well. All signs point that that's probably eventually going to happen. And I think a lot of these players, I think more players are going to jump over on this if it continues to kind of go that way. My point being, disc golf's not there, but yes, we've seen it where someone comes in, offers players a lot of money, and they immediately jump ship. So I don't see that not happening if that ever did happen in disc golf, but it's not, I don't think it's going to happen.
All right. Well, there you have it. Silas, do we have any questions or comments from the chat yet?
Oh yeah, we got some.
Heck yeah.
We got some. Here we go. Let's go. Number one. We're just going to start from the furthest away all the way to the most relevant.
Okay.
The newest. We got one for Brody. Brody, what do you think your biggest weakness in your game is right now?
Ooh.
Or what are you working on the most?
I mean, putting has definitely been causing me. That's the thing that you just can't. You can't miss easy putts. And if you are going to miss an easy putt, it needs to be like once a tournament, maybe two a tournament, something like that. So I think the first round at Blue Lake, I can't remember exactly what the number is, but I think I missed like four or five putts inside the circle. Most of those also were for birdie, so that hurts a lot. But yeah, I mean, I'm finishing towards the bottom of the field the last couple weeks with putting, like circle 1X putting. My circle 2 putting has actually been pretty good. So it's just those like 20 to 28 footers are killing me right now. So I've been working on that a lot. My putting was much better on Sunday at the Portland Open. I ended up only missing one, I believe, inside a circle. And that wasn't until that was on the hole 18, unfortunately. But I'd say that's been killing me the most. And then the other thing would probably be just not getting the disc close to, like, getting it close enough to the basket on, like, kind of easy upshots. Those two things probably were the biggest ones. I birdied a lot of holes this past weekend. Birdied a lot of holes.
Yeah.
And my strokes gained tee to green has always been like top 25, I think, at most of these events. So, yeah.
All right. There we have it. Second one. And we can kind of, Hunter, you can chime in on this as well.
Okay.
I don't know if you will. But okay. What is, Brody, what's your take on the rowdy crowd during Simon and Garrett Gerthy's putts and throws? I'm guessing on that last hole. Did you watch any of that coverage or were you there for that?
I want to say I watched like the last, because I was, when I finished my round, I was practiced for like an hour and a half. So when I was done, I want to say I caught like the last three holes on live. Live's really hard to tell sometimes too with their audio. I don't know what they're doing, kind of with like how they're syncing in the audio there. But sometimes it's kind of, you can't really hear it until after the fact. I actually thought the Portland crowd was the closest to how I would love a disc golf crowd to be. I think a disc golf crowd can be a lot more rowdy than a golf tournament. I don't think it needs to be as uptight as a golf tournament. And when you go to a golf tournament right now, they're more rowdy than a disc golf tournament. Like, one thing I would love, so if you're listening and you're going to go to a tournament, one thing I absolutely would love to see more and hear as a player is if we're like on a par four or whatever hole it is that we're like throwing far, as soon as, like, obviously be quiet as the players, you know, getting ready to throw. But as soon as that disc releases, like, if you want to yell out something or cheer or scream or whatever, like a roar or whatever, like, I think that energy is awesome. And also, like, when a good shot happens, like, hooting and hollering, all that, I don't think we need to feel like we can't be loud. Like, I think players especially need to get used to playing a tournament where there's fans. You're going to have times where you're setting up a putt and a huge roar happens a couple holes away. Like, these are all things that are going to happen. And I don't think we want to shy away from that. I don't think we want to be in a spot where we're telling fans, or fans are feeling like they can't move, they can't talk, they can't do anything. Clearly, like, there's certain situations where, yes, like, if you're 50 feet away from a player, probably shouldn't be talking or moving around when they're setting up the shot. But I love the rowdiness. I thought the Portland crowd was awesome. It was incredible to play in front of. We had a decent crowd a couple days. Actually, I think both days at Glendevere, we actually had a decent crowd following, which was awesome. 18 had a decent amount of people just chilling there. So, you know, even though I played 18 terrible both days, it was still cool to kind of throw shots and putts and with a big crowd around. But yeah, I'm all for the rowdiness. Again, a time and a place for it. But to me, that's one thing that I think can set us apart a little bit from golf, is it's not as polished. It's not as, like, buttoned up.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. I was going to say basically,
the golf clap doesn't need to exist.
No. I was going to say basically, as soon as a disc comes out of a player's hand, whether it be a putt, a throw, whatever, then, like, to me, it's fair game. Yell, scream, whatever. I think it's a good time.
Yeah.
I think when a player's lining up or is in the throwing motion, obviously that's a no-go because you don't want to distract the player. Yeah. But, like, as soon as it's out of their hand, yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple people saying in the comments that they were loud during their, like, as they were going up to look at their shot and that kind
of
stuff.
Like, if you're walking up the fairway and players are like, let's go, like, people are yelling, let's go Simon, let's go Garrett, whatever, I'm fine with that too.
Yeah.
I think it's once the player is actually, like, addressing their lie and, like, getting focused, that's when it needs like shh. Yeah. And that's when the quiet sign should go up. It should be the volunteers.
I actually disagree. I don't even think I think that's even too soon. I think it's when the player if I'm walking up to my disc, I've technically, I guess, has addressed the lie.
I'm saying like when you're like lining up your putt.
Oh, okay. You're talking about putting, not necessarily throwing a shot.
Throwing, I think it's it's once you have your disc and you're like ready to about to start your run up, then it's
yes.
But I think that's where like the volunteer comes in of like they need to have the quiet sign and raise it.
Yeah, they hold up the sign. Yeah.
But until until the quiet sign's up, then fair game.
Well, and the volunteer shouldn't hold that up until the player has, like you said, addressed their lie, getting ready to putt.
Yeah,
right. And I specifically in Portland, I think there could have been like a catch cam down near the basket that they could have been pulling audio from when the players may not have been all the way down there. So you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You don't know where the audio is coming
from. Yeah. It's kind of hard to judge that. But anyway.
Let's make sure to say get rowdy.
I just want to hear like a get in the basket. Like someone has like a circle two putt. You know, and it's 50 feet, so there is some air time between the putt and it getting to the basket. And as soon as the disc release, you see, get in the basket. Like, that would get me. I mean, obviously, if I made the putt, it would be good. If I missed the putt, it would kind of suck a little bit. But like, if I heard that as the disc is flying and then it cashes in, like, oh man, that would be awesome.
So as long as they don't yell, like they have to be after the disc releases your hands.
Yeah, nothing correct? To distract a player.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I just want clarification because some people are saying some other things.
So. The roars out there though, because I was still on the course obviously when the lead card was going through.
Yeah.
The roars were loud. So like I think obviously there's a time and place for it as well, right? Like I'm playing for 30th place. You know, me making a putt, you're going to probably get like a nice putt. Like, but now if I'm contending for the lead and I make a putt, you know, obviously the rowdiness is probably going to be a little bit more there because that putt actually matters. So yeah, that's what I loved is I saw when people were contending and stuff like was getting serious and the drama was building and all that stuff. Like, people were getting loud. People were cheering loud. And it was awesome to kind of hear those echoes of the cheers throughout the course.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as a player, that's what you want to play in front of that. You know, like, I don't want to play where, you know, obviously I love having whoever comes out and watches, but I want to be in spots where, like, my putts, like, significantly matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it depends on the player, too.
Yeah, I'm sure some players don't like it, but
good under pressure, or if you're not.
I mean, that's the same in any sport. Like, but it's just, are you built for the moment or not?
Yeah.
Like if you're not going to be good and playing in front of crowds, then just don't get on lead card. Basically, how it should be.
Or just get used to it.
Yeah, like those are your only options. Like either don't be in contention for the lead or get used to it.
But the thing is, as disc golf gets bigger and bigger and bigger, like. I'm the perfect example, right? Where I can be in 40th place. So you could be in 40th place on my card, and now all of a sudden you're playing in front of 50, 100 people.
Yeah, there's still gonna be a gallery where people are.
That could be like galleries are going to. You know, I saw. I want to say it was like who was it? Sexton, Calvin, or no? It wasn't even Sexton. Calvin. I think it was just Calvin. It was Calvin and. I don't know if there was another big name on his card, and it was on Saturday. It wasn't even final day. It was on Saturday. He had like 75 people watching his card.
Yeah.
So like that's going to happen. Like as disc golf continues to get bigger and bigger, as more fans are coming to these events, which we have seen a trend over the last couple events, like especially when you're going to these bigger cities, I think that's what disc golf needs to do too. Like we need to stop going to like small little cities. Like, we need to go to big cities. Like there's a lot of people in Portland. So I wasn't surprised to see tons of people come out to the Portland Open versus like a Jonesboro. Now, granted, the local community and disc golf community in Jonesboro is big and a lot of them did come out and support. But like, in my opinion, if we played instead of in Jonesboro, if we played in like somewhere in Atlanta, we're probably going to get way more people to come out to the event if we're in Atlanta than in Jonesboro. So yeah. Like Emporia might be like the only exception to that. But also I would argue that if Emporia didn't have like a big AM tournament going on at the same time, I don't think the crowds would be that big.
Mm.
I think a lot of those people that are at that tournament are there because there's an AM tournament.
Yeah.
I would assume so. Well, so like that would be an interesting one.
You'll see Worlds would be a great example.
If you can't get people to come in for a world championship, then you're not going to get people to come in for just an elite series. So that would be a great that like if tons of people come in, then you know, jury's still out on whether or not it makes sense to do that for like a smaller tournament. But if you hold the world championship and we can't get thousands of people to come out to that event, then I think that is something that probably needs to be looked at from the Pro Tour side of like, where are we actually having these events?
Yeah.
Because Portland, like I said, like Portland was incredible. Even OTB, which isn't like Stockton's not the biggest city in the world, but it's a decent sized city with tons of big cities around it. That crowd was crazy too. So I would love to continue to kind of see these crowd sizes grow and grow and grow, because when you're actually on the course too, as a spectator, and you're like looking around and there's tons of spectators spread out, I think that just looks better for the sport than literally everyone just watching one card.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's kind of like what we talked about the other night, just like getting tournaments in bigger cities. Next up, we got a little debate maybe here.
Ooh.
What do y'all think about the last hole of the tournament? Thoughts, this guy's saying, thoughts on the choice of Simon chose to throw big. Good decision, bad decision, risky?
Go ahead, Hunter, because you've probably already talked about this on Grip Lock. So
I wasn't on Grip Lock this week, but... Here's what I'll say. So yeah, I know. It was like my second time I've ever missed Grip Locked. But my initial thing with it was a player going for the win. Like, is a player going for the win? Like, I think that's great. With Simon's post interview, I think it was a little bit of a more unique situation, because from what I understand, he basically said that's the only shot he practiced. So like that was a shot he felt comfortable with. So it wasn't necessarily like he was getting aggressive and going for the win. But in that type of scenario in general, go for it.
Well, I disagree with, like, there's no way that's the only shot he felt comfortable with.
That's what he said, that that's the only line he practiced. So he said, like, didn't practice anything else. Like, that's what he felt comfortable with.
Yeah, but the shot that the non-aggressive shot there is literally... who's he? Dysmania. So what is that? That's like a tilt. No, they don't throw tilts. What do they throw forehands?
Dysmania, like a splice,
overstable
splice.
Raptor,
yeah. FD3,
like an overstable raptor,
like an FD3. Like an overstable.
Okay, so that's like a forehand 250-foot.
But he has. He's had his elbow thing where he hasn't been able to throw forehand much.
Then it's a 250-foot putter shot.
Yeah.
To a straight putter shot or a turnover putter shot onto a fairway that's 100 feet wide.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like I'm just going to say it's not like there's a gap or there's some sort of like, I never practiced that line. And like, it's just a stock 250-foot straight shot with another stock 250-foot straight shot. So I think what he meant was like, he just always in his head had the idea that he was going to go for it.
Yeah. Well, regardless,
I just want to make that. Yeah. I want to make that clear where Simon was. If Simon's in that spot and you're like, Simon, you have to make birdie, he's making birdie 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah.
No doubt in my mind. He's making birdie from there 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah. I've always sat on this side of the fence, and I think I always will. I just think when a player is in a situation where they could lay up and like hope that the tournament works out for them, or they can go for it and know, like, hey, if I make this shot, if this happens, I'm going to win. Like, I'm making a play that if this executes, I'm putting all the pressure on this person. And like that type of, like, that's a shot going for the win. I like that play every time. Because I feel like if you go for the win and you lose, you know in your head, like, I did what all I could do. Versus you lay up and you lose, and you're like, you'll always be thinking, what if I didn't?
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, it's a lot more exciting.
You think it's crazy to say that if Simon would have laid up there, that Gerthy probably would have won? Is that crazy to say?
I think that's crazy to say, yeah.
Because I think there's probably a decent percentage.
What changes?
That
What changes if Gerthy, Simon lays Gerthy up and he's goes inbound. For it.
Gerthy goes for it. And Gerthy had a
disc
in his
hand. Wasn't
he
already going for it?
Yeah. What do you mean?
He threw the big forehand, but it went OB.
Oh, he was laying
up. He wasn't
up.
Going for it.
That's,
he was trying to
lay
up.
That's a layup play.
Okay.
Gerthy had a disc in his hand to go for it. Saw Simon throw out of bounds, and then he went with the forehand.
Ah.
So what I, because obviously when Simon goes out of bounds, immediately in your head, you're like, if I birdie this,
I win. Yeah.
Right? But what I'm thinking is Garrett's go-to shot there, like his shot that I think he is way more comfortable throwing, is that turnover backhand.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking if he goes for it, right? At worst, it crosses in bounds up there. He pitches up, and we're like, we're going to a playoff. If Simon goes out of bounds, and then Gerthy still goes for it. But I just feel like if Simon lays up and Garrett was like under the impression of like, I'm going for it, with how well he was throwing, with how well he was putting, I would put a lot of money that he gets up and down from there.
Mm.
Like I put a lot of money into it. So I think it was one of those situations where what Garrett did, you can't like fault it. Like,
yeah.
I think everyone in that situation would have done exactly what Garrett would have done is, Simon went out of bounds. He's not going to make birdie from there. All I have to do is chip par. I would say the only thing that maybe people have a question with is like, why does he not throw a turnover rock there? Why does he go with a forehand? I would say that would be like the only thing.
But see what I'm saying of like, even in Garrett's situation, if we flip it on its head, because obviously it was asked about Simon, even in Garrett's situation, if he's laying down at night, he's thinking through the scenario and he's like, if only I would have went for it, which I guess if he went for it and went OB, then he's probably thinking, such an easy chip.
But in Simon's shoes, farther back,
I think you go for that every time because you're taking initiative and you're putting pressure on someone.
Well, he also, if I'm in Simon's shoes as well there, I'm also knowing that Garrett has been, I mean, Garrett literally, if you watch coverage, if you guys go back and watch, Garrett was so good.
Yeah.
At Glendevere especially, he was so good. He was throwing incredible shots and literally that day, he was making every putt. Like any putt he was staring at, I don't know how he was doing it, but it was just dropping him in the basket. And if I'm Simon there, then yeah, I'm 100% thinking in my head, like,
he's getting up and down.
If I lay up here, like, that's going to suck if Garrett just steps up and throws this 450-foot turnover and, you know, throws it to 30 feet. That's going to suck. So, you know, it's one, again, I think the conversation actually.
That's an interesting take that Simon going out actually won it for him.
I think the conversation here is it should be actually not so much on what Simon and Garrett did, more on look at these type of holes, and especially holes towards the end of a tournament. These are the type of holes we want.
Yeah.
Because if this was a par three and Simon goes OB, like Garrett's just still throwing his same shot. Like a lot of holes on tour we play. There's no decision being made.
Yeah.
Like if you're playing match play with someone, regardless of what they did, you're still probably going to play the same way. This hole, that's not the case.
Yeah.
And I love that. So yeah. I think that's what the conversation should be more is like, how do we get more holes like this? How do we design courses to finish with holes like this? Because that tournament would have been so boring if it finished with, I mean, Jonesboro hole 18, another hole. That's an incredible finishing hole. right? You have decisions to be made off that. Like this whole, this course would have, or this tournament would have really been kind of lame had that final hole been like, eh, because then we would have probably just gone to the playoff.
Yeah. All right, Silas, let's get one more.
Yeah.
If there is one more.
All right.
Wrap it up with this.
One to follow that is, what's the proper final round interview look like? What do you think, Brody? Do you like, here, I'll rephrase it. Do you like when the TD or whoever presents their trophy runs out there and then Brian Earhart immediately comes up to him and he's like asking him questions, interview right on the spot? Or do you like the post-round interview?
Here's the thing. I'm trying to think. There's always like some sort of thing, some sort of finalization of the tournament that happens before the interview happens, before the trophy presentation, before anything like that. The closest thing I can think of is like MMA, where as soon as they announce the winner, you know, DC, Joe Rogan, whoever's there, is coming in with an interview. But the time from when the fight happened, like when the fight ends to when they announce the winner, there's like a massive gap there. There's normally like a good solid minute, 2-3 minutes, but it's not like the fight just ends. They have to, like, when it goes to like a decision, and even when you knock someone out, like when you knock someone out, the person celebrates a bunch, goes around, all the coaches come in. A lot of times, like, obviously the person that gets knocked out has like medical attention. They try to get him back up to where they can like both be. And then they announce the winner by TKO or whatever. And then the announcer comes in. I think that's like the soonest, because I'm even thinking like NBA, like for the NBA finals or even the playoffs that are going on right now, right? Like when the game's over, you have, you know, the opposite team like immediately goes to the locker room because they don't shake hands until the series is over, which I'm fine with because you're literally playing the team again. But normally you have the players and stuff like celebrate all that stuff. The coaches, I do think maybe do the coaches shake? That would be interesting.
A lot of times they do. Yeah.
After every game, regardless. Okay.
Typically.
I'm not sure, but yeah, there's stuff going on for like a minute or two. And then you'll have, like the NBC, they'll cut down to whoever's on, you know, the floor to get the interview. So there normally is like a time there. My biggest thing with disc golf is you're announcing the winner before the winner is actually official. That is my biggest thing, because all that needs to happen eventually is, this would suck, but all that would have to happen is like you do all this stuff and then Simon goes and figures out a scorecard and something is wrong, and they post the wrong score and he gets a 2-stroke penalty and he loses. Like, that's the crazy thing to me. And that obviously it's a crazy situation and potentially will never happen. But when we finish our rounds now, the Disc Golf Pro Tour has done a great job of having a spot for us to have to go and finalize our scores and submit our scores. A lot of times you actually have a TD, someone from the PDGA, someone from the Disc Golf Pro Tour, someone like that, some official there to make sure that everything is finalized and good to go. It's crazy to me that just gets bypassed with the final card. That's the crazy thing. So to me, I feel like Simon wins, celebrate, do whatever, but then like he, like, also I'll say this too. Some people, I'm starting to convert some people on handshaking after hole 18 versus on hole 18's tee.
There you go.
I'm starting to convert some people. And I heard that the reason why that started in disc golf, like the whole reason why that was a thing, was because people would just leave after they putted on 18. They would just peace out and leave. So they're like, oh, let's start doing on 18. That doesn't happen on the Disc Golf Pro Tour.
No.
Because you have to turn in your scores. So again, this is something that I think can be different on the Pro Tour than it happens in, you know, leagues and in smaller tournaments. But like, to me, I think Simon putts out, you know, all the people come up and say, hey, great playing with you, caddies, all that stuff. Then walk to the scoring tent, finalize your score, make sure all the scores are right. And you know, you don't have a 5 on one hole and a 3 on another. And you actually had a 4 and a four. I'm trying to think of how that works, but like something to where it's like, make sure everything is good. And then come back and then have the trophy presentation. Like, because that's the other thing too, is like, you can set up the trophy presentation to be a little nicer, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can have some sort of like, I don't know, like Worlds was pretty sweet. Like the way Worlds did it. Now, I don't know if that's because, well, no, that's not true. They just rushed in real quick and handed him the trophy.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird though, because it is a playoff. So I think a playoff might be different though.
Yeah.
Because you've already finalized your score. But I think it's kind of cool to have that like moment of yeah, you know, Simon's walking to the scoring tent, giving high fives to all the fans. Everyone's cheering for him. He's finalizing the score. He comes back. Everyone's just cheering. Then you can have the people come in, the sponsors, all that stuff, do the trophy presentation, and then the interview. Now there's like a 5 to 7 minute gap, or, you know, it's probably not even more. It's probably 3 or 5 minutes gap. Simon's more composed.
Yeah.
I think you have the interview.
I think even on the flip side, presentation wise, it does a few things. Because if you watched this coverage, the Brian Earhart interview, it wasn't as bad as Silas and Trevor made it.
It was
nowhere near as bad as they make it out to be. But it wasn't a great interview by any means.
It's not Brian's fault, though.
No, well, no, what I was saying no, is Brian not. Is having to the whole time mentally prepare for 2 interviews. Because up until hole 18 happens, he has Garrett or Simon, and he doesn't know which he's going to have. So he has to now compose himself, get his questions, and he has 30 seconds to do it, maybe less. Luckily, Simon did this runaround thing like he does, but he could have had no time at all to prepare that interview. But what was interesting, though, was they had that interview. Then a few minutes later, they had, in like the post thing, the Grant guy from the PDGA had Garrett and Simon back-to-back interviews. And the interview that Simon gave, not necessarily, some of it was the questions he was asked, sure, but the interview Simon was able to give from the one he gave to Brian and the one he gave to Grant with the PDGA on the same broadcast, minutes separating them, were worlds different. He was able to compose himself, let the moment sink in, then give an interview. And I thought that was a great example because it did 2 things. One, it allowed the interviewer to be more prepared because he now had minutes to go through the round, make sure he had the key points of what happened during the round, make sure he had the good talking points, all of that. And 2, it gave Simon a chance to let the wind sink in and then have his emotions like where he can actually process questions and stuff like that. And so the interview was a much better product a few minutes later because it wasn't just an immediate like, wow, I just won again. Okay, now I have these questions being thrown at me type thing. So
I like the interview in front of the crowd though.
No, I agree. I think they should just bring out like a backdrop and like a little podium and then that's like the trophy presentation.
No backdrop. No,
it doesn't have to be a back something. Anything.
You have all the crowd. You have the crowd as the backdrop. Sure. That's cool.
I'm just saying, like, you can put up like a temporary stage or something. Something you make a little spot for a presentation.
Hey, here's what I think. Okay, look, I was watching NASCAR on Sunday, and the way they do it is that as soon as the guy wins, he does the donuts.
Yeah.
On the checkered.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yep. In the grass.
And then he goes into the pit lane. And he goes to the like stage where he gets the trophy and he does the interview. Like, I feel like it should be more like that.
Well, if they can have a stage
Silas,
and trophy.
Silas, you know why they don't have interviews right after someone wins NASCAR. You've heard the story, right?
No, what are you talking about?
An interviewer tried to like immediately once a NASCAR driver won, try to go out and get an interview and got ran over. So that's obviously why they don't do that right after the race.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes
That's
sense.
That's fair. They,
but, all right, anyway.
The, but I, for, as far as the Pro Tour goes, I also think.
Rest in peace.
I also think, yeah. I also think as far as the Pro Tour goes, it would make the tournament feel more complete if you had a time where Simon taps in, you know, you get the cinematic shots of him with the crowd, all of that. It gives whoever the commentary team is time to summarize the event, summarize what you just watched, go to commercial, whatever you got to do. Get like that B-roll stuff going.
Also, just stay on Simon.
Yeah,
too. Like, literally, have a camera follow him.
That's what I'm saying. That's a great time for the people, for the commentators to give analysis on what you just watched. Break it all down for you. Have a highlight package of Simon throughout the round, throughout the tournament, how he got to the win, and then you come back to the trophy presentation, the interview, and it puts a nice bow on the whole thing. Versus this chaotic mess of Brian's mic's already on and he doesn't know, and he's like, all right, so you're gonna count me in, all right, Simon, you're gonna count me in, okay, and we're here with Simon. Like, none of that will have to happen if it's more just like, all right, let's process through it, you know, and it's all just a more established setup thing versus you have Terry or Brian pushing fans out of the way to try to get to Simon before he walks away. And like, that's just I'm shocked it hasn't been changed yet, but they must think it's better. Because, I mean, I'm getting tired of talking about it at this point, because I feel like every tournament it gets brought up on Grip Locked or Debate Night or somewhere where it's just like, all I have to talk about it.
The thing is regardless of how cringy it is or all that stuff, it's still like you have to sign, like, there. You still have to, like, not sign. We don't do scorecards like that, but, like, you still have to finalize your score. So that's the thing that, to me, that's just the thing that makes no sense at all.
Oh, yeah, because, like, what if there is a provisional? Like, what if, like, there is a provisional and that doesn't show on UDisc? So, like, he played a provisional on hole three.
Or what if there's a... What if... I'm trying to think who else was on that card. Garrett and...
Paul.
And then who's the other person? Isaac.
Yeah.
So what if, you know, say, like... Simon's, you know, celebrating whatever he just won, and that now he's being interviewed, and like Garrett and Isaac are over there like, all right, let's finalize these scores, right? And like there's an issue, like Simon's now just like not with Simon's score, not
but with one
Simon's
of theirs
score,
yeah issue,
with one of theirs, like Isaac's like, oh, I have a three here, and Garrett's like, I have you as a four. Like, is Simon just not involved in that conversation at all? Like, that's where it's just like, to me, Let's just get the scores finalized.
Well, it's also funny. Then, what was the tournament? It was a silver series, I think. Sarah Hokum just won a few weeks ago now.
She won Masters Cup.
Masters Cup. And she won it from Chase Card. And so the scene was like somewhat awkward, or it was a weird to watch, because basically what happened was they tapped out on the green and it's down here. And then up on top of the hill by like the tee, yeah, by like hole one's tee or somewhere. And, and then as soon as it like they tap out, it cuts to the camera and they're like on top of the hill watching, and then like turn around for the trophy presentation to Sarah Hokum, and like the lead cards in the background still finish like wrapping up the tournament behind her.
Love that.
And I'm
love
like, because we, Trevor and I were like texting back and forth as it was happening. I was like, I've got to see like how are they going to handle this. Because, like, you don't walk up to lead card and do it right now. And it was like, oh, no, they just had a camera and mic and everything, like, 500 feet away with Sarah, and made sure she was, like, set apart. But they still, like, the second the final putt was tapped in by the person who ended up coming in third or fourth or whatever, as soon as that putt was tapped in, it just cut over to Sarah Hokum.
So you know what happens in golf, how that works, right? Is, like, a lot of times the players in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
Like, and they're watching it in the clubhouse. And a lot of times there is a camera on the player. So, you know, you'll see, like, let's say someone had a putt to tie the player. Well, not even that. If it's something where, like, they are close to having to play in a playoff,
then they're warming up.
They won't
up.
Be in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
They're warming up. But as soon as it's finalized and they know they won, they'll, like, you know, high five their caddy or whatever like that. And then, like, they're in the clubhouse. Like, they now have to make their way out to the 18th green to where the trophy presentation is going to be. So there's still, even then in that scenario, there still is a gap.
Yeah.
But like, yes, we don't have like clubhouses or anything like that. So like, if you're Sarah Hokum, like, I mean, are you just like going to your van and you're just like sitting in your van watching coverage? It's kind of awkward.
They get a camera on her in her van.
Yeah, it makes it more awkward when we don't really have a place to go when the tournament is over.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you do that better, honestly. Like, I don't have really a suggestion on it when someone wins that's not on lead card, but yeah.
All right. Well, there you have it. That wraps it up for this week on Debate Night. We'll be back again next Tuesday, probably a different time. Same place, though.
Oh, people want us to talk about Val real quick. Did they not talk? Did you guys not talk about?
I wasn't on Grip.
Hey, no, we talked about Val. Let me tell you, Val's a beast. All right, that's all.
Silas was on Grip Block this week.
Yeah, I was. That's all that needs to be said. Val's a beast, and she's now top four in your power rankings.
She's been top four. She's been top four.
Can we just say, when we were trying to figure out who we wanted to sponsor going into this year, that Val was potentially the biggest no-brainer of all time.
Yeah.
Like
I said before in the off season, I said without a shadow of a doubt, Val was the best dynamic FPO signing. I said there's no doubt in my mind. I said Val was going to be more important than the Kona signing. And I stand
like,
by
watching,
that.
Watching Val, a couple things to point out. One, her like upside is extremely high.
Yeah.
She has an insane upside. But like, beside the fact that her game right now is really, really good and she can continue to get better and she is getting better, she might be one of the best under pressure in the FPO field. She might be one of the best because
she's battle tested.
Obviously, she blew out the field in this event, but like, go back to Waco when she won Waco and threw that shot on hole 17. That is a very hard shot, and yeah, she just nailed it. So
yeah,
she's someone that literally can like, she can play under the pressure, and her game is so good. She's one of the best putters on FPO, and that was like an absolute no-brainer for us to sign her. She's an awesome person as well, which is just cookies on top of the cake, I guess. I don't know if that's the saying. Probably
it
sprinkles.
Is now. Sprinkles
probably,
works.
Probably makes more sense.
Icing on the cake is the actual phrase, but
icing on the cake. But yeah, I mean that was impressive to watch. It was also interesting because I was talking to Mason before we teed off on Sunday. And I was basically being like, yeah, so, well, not on Sunday. Sorry. I saw Mason. I think he came over and was practicing a little bit after his round on Saturday. So going into Sunday, I was talking to Mason. I was like, yeah, so it's like Val going to kind of, you know, play a little bit, you know, safe and like basically make it to where someone has to try to chase her down. Because especially a course like that, like we didn't see outside of Val shooting as hot as she did. We didn't really see any other, you know, I think Kate Mersch might have shot 6 under, which was a really good round as well. But there wasn't like really low scoring out there for the FPO. So her like shooting even par and someone shooting like 8 under is like probably very unlikely to happen.
Yeah.
Even if she did end up playing bad. But he was like, no, she's just going to play aggressive. She likes playing. Like he was like, no, she's just going to keep going for stuff, which I was like, dang. Okay. Well,
yeah,
I mean, you're feeling it, but yeah, I mean, that was the impressive. That was probably one of the more impressive wins. Now, obviously Kristen's not here.
Yeah.
Right. So but Kristen was at Waco, right?
Kristen was at Waco. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Kristen hasn't finished outside the top three this year, which is very impressive.
Obviously, Kristen's still the number one player in the world, but I think Val, if you didn't have her already as a top FPO player, you definitely do now. I think everyone has been alerted that Val is in the building.
Yeah, I think Val and Gannon are similar in the aspects of, they've played disc golf for a long time, even though they're both, I mean, Gannon's younger than Valerie is, but they both have like amateur and junior world titles and stuff like that, where even though it's not the same scale of pressure from a fan's perspective, it's a very similar scale of pressure on a player, because like AM and Junior Worlds, that is like your entire world there. And so when you're going to those things and you've won multiple of them, and then Valerie, she went and she just dominated the local FPO scene. So like she and her sister Alexis know how to win in those type of tournaments. So in those type of situations, to where like I feel like when pressure comes up, she's a lot more acclimated to it than some of the players who they get their battle wounds on tour, and it's like their first time with a chance to win might be their first time with a chance to win, versus a player like Gannon or Valerie, where they've won majors on the amateur level and stuff like that. They've been in close fights, they've been in playoffs, and so they already have some of that experience, and now it's just like on a different stage to a certain extent. So,
oh, for sure. And if I was like, if I was obviously 10, 15 years younger than I was now, like, I think that is definitely the path that you want to go. You want to go on the path of putting yourself in positions to win as much as you possibly can. And if you just go straight to the disc golf, if you go straight to the pro tour, it's not going to happen. So
yeah,
it's not going to happen, at least right off the bat. So I think that's obviously the path for a lot of players. And it should be the path for a lot of players, is like playing local, playing maybe even regional, big regional events, and like getting used to winning those events and getting yourself in those positions, because obviously it's a little bit of a different ballgame. But like you said, you know, when you have those kind of experiences to look back on, when you get into that spot in a bigger tournament, you're not going to be as like flustered or, you know, deer in the headlights of like, holy cow, what's going on? So
yeah,
Val's an absolute killer. What I definitely want, I mean, obviously no one was really pushing her this week. So I think it's something that we have all been wanting to happen in FPO for some time, of where we see multiple FPO players like pushing each other. A lot of times we get like one or two. We're getting closer and closer to where we could have a tournament where there's like four people, five people just all shooting lights out, and that tournament's gonna be insane.
Yeah.
Obviously it doesn't happen in MPO, you know, past tournaments. It's an example. It was literally Simon and Garrett. Everyone else was playing for third and fourth. But it's always fun when you get those, like, that I can't wait until that happens more. I feel like it's going to. I don't know why it hasn't, but I feel like it's going to, like, where people from like Chase Card like put a score down where like they have to get chased down, and we don't know if it's going to happen or not.
Yeah.
Like, it's so rare for that to happen, but I would love for, I don't know.
Well, we're definitely getting close, because like, I mean, what you just said, it was Simon and Garrett, you know, and the rest of the field was trying to catch them. Like, that sentence a few years ago sounds so foreign, because it was like, they used to not be where week in and week out, it was, you didn't know who was going to be the top three players at the tournament.
Oh, your guys' predictions are probably so hard this year.
It's way more fun.
You guys,
yeah.
You guys doing the top three?
Yeah, you can mix in. You always mix in a Ricky, Calvin, or Paul, but you always throw in a Gannon, Simon. You have to throw in like a hot hand, and like you aren't a crazy person to throw, like, to pick Drew Gibson and throw him in there. Like, a year or two ago, it was like you went Ricky, Paul, Calvin, or Ricky, Eagle, Calvin, or Ricky, Eagle, Paul. And like, if you didn't have those three, then
you might sprinkle Chris in there if he was playing the other.
But like, the past several years, like, if you didn't have those three, you were a crazy person. Now this year, if you had just those three, it's like, well, you're gonna get one and maybe two of the three, but you're not getting the top three. So,
and then same thing with FPO too.
It's getting there more and more. Yeah.
Obviously, you have probably Kristen, I would say, in every single one. But like, you wouldn't be crazy to not have Paige in your top three. You wouldn't be crazy to not have Kat in your top three.
Yeah.
And a couple years ago, there's no way you're not having those two in the top three every single tournament. Yeah. So
it's definitely getting more exciting. But that wraps it up for this week's show. We'll be back again next Tuesday night, around the same time. Might be a little earlier. We'll have to wait and see what happens next week, but thank you all so much for tuning in, and
I'll be in Dallas.
I didn't know where you'll be. All right, so it'll be earlier next week.
I'm back.
He'll be back next in Dallas
off week
back
off
in Dallas week. Next week, so it'll be a little earlier, But be sure to check out the Beaver State Fleeing Silver Series going on this weekend, and we'll talk to you all next week.